For WHQR Public Media, this is The Newsroom. I'm Kelly Knoyer. Thank you for joining us. I've covered homelessness for my entire journalistic career. At my first job in Eugene, Oregon, in Portland, and in small-town Sweet Home. And now here. A year after I started my professional career, a paradigm-shifting federal ruling changed how cities interact with the homeless, at least on the West Coast. It was called Martin v. Boise, a Ninth District Circuit Court case where six homeless plaintiffs sued the city of Boise for its anti-camping ordinance. The plaintiffs won in federal court, a decision on the basis of the Eighth Amendment's prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment. The argument was this: if I have nowhere to lay my head at night, I must legally be permitted to lay my head on the ground of public property. Later clarifications of the ruling gave homeless people in the Ninth District the right to shelter and blankets so they wouldn't die from exposure or from the cold. It forced cities to confront the fact of homelessness, at least in the nine states and two territories covered by the Ninth Circuit Court. Suddenly, cities couldn't force the homeless to just move along unless they had somewhere to offer them a bed. Cities were required to provide shelter if they wanted to enforce trespassing laws on public property. I watched my home state become overrun. Portland saw encampments crop up in every park and on many sidewalks. Even small-town Sweet Home, population 10,000, was forced to allow campers to live on church property rather than throwing them in jail. Over time, though, those towns and cities began addressing the problem with solutions outside the justice system. Portland built permanent shelters, as did most every municipality and county in the region. Government was forced to step up in order to clean up their parks and streets. For 6 years, that reality was the law of the land, until this year, when the Supreme Court ruled on Grants Pass v. Johnson, overturning the Ninth Circuit ruling. Now, cities and towns can trespass people from public property, create bans on sleeping in public, and fine or jail those with nowhere else to go. It doesn't feel like a significant change here in Wilmington, where New Hanover County already passed a ban on sleeping overnight on its property. But to me, an Oregonian here in North Carolina, it does seem like a clear new line. Government doesn't need to do anything to help the poorest among us, but it can punish those people just for existing. There's been a lot of news coverage of this ruling and its fallout, but much of it's been abstract. So in light of the ruling, curtailing the rights of the unhoused, I thought it was about time we meet these people, where they are. Homeless people are dehumanized, ignored, and told how to behave more than almost any other category of human being. So we decided to do the opposite, to look closely at their personal stories, hear from them what their lives are like, and how they got here. All next week, I'll be bringing these profiles to the airwaves, and you'll be able to find them on WHQR.org. But I wanted you to see them too, listeners. That's why I brought on freelance photographer Madeline Gray to join me in this reporting. She's a phenomenal photojournalist whose work can be found in The Assembly, The Washington Post, NPR, and The New York Times. And we are so lucky to have her here in Wilmington, North Carolina. Thanks for joining me, Maddie.
Thanks so much, Kelly. I'm really glad to be here.
So, what made you interested in working on this project with me? I know why I'm interested.
Yeah, I think it's many of the same points that you just talked about. I think I'm always, as a photojournalist, as a storyteller, I'm always interested less in the policies and politics and more in how those policies affect everyday people's lives. And I think that is so important to show. And that's really the motivation for doing this story.
Yeah, I think that for me, working with a photographer kind of helped ground me in the personal stories, which was really helpful because I tend to be a little bit of a policy wonk about these things. And I think that I can take that sky high view a lot of the time. And so this was a really valuable exercise for me also in really talking to the people affected by those policies. What was it like kind of going through this process on your end?
Yeah, so I think it was different in the way that you were talking about how you have covered homelessness and the homeless community for a long time. And despite having been a photographer for over 15 years, that was really not a community that I've spent very much time with. So when I moved to Wilmington about 3.5 years ago, it was immediately obvious that affordable housing is a huge issue in this region. And then just, you know, anytime you're downtown, we live sort of close to Greenfield Lake, you see people who are unhoused. But it was not a community that I had really talked to or interacted with much. So for me, getting to actually hear a lot of those stories, I think what surprised me maybe the most was just how relatable they are, how so many people shared their like one moment or one incident that was really the catalyst that forced them to become unhoused. And so hearing those stories, you can't help but think many, many other people in our communities are in similar situations. And I think also what's always continues to amaze me about this job is even when people are potentially at their most vulnerable, they are still willing to open up and share their experiences, and they are just so giving of their time and their energy. And again, that just still continues to constantly amaze me. So I feel very lucky that so many people were willing to share their experiences.
You know, I kind of expected people to not be willing to share their names with us because there's such a stigma around homelessness. I mean, I don't know that I know a lot of people who will admit that they've been homeless. If they are working in a job or something like that, they might not necessarily share that information because of that stigma. But that wasn't the experience we had. Everybody seemed pretty willing to be on the record with their name and their face and everything.
I felt exactly the same way. People were so forthcoming. And also, I felt they were very honest with some of the circumstances that had led them to become homeless, which I wasn't sure we would find.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of folks are willing to admit mistakes that they've made, and it's often a mistake or just a tragedy that leads people to these places. You haven't really dug into homelessness in particular. Was there anything that was particularly challenging about this topic?
Yeah, I think that probably the most challenging thing was just my own hesitation that I brought to the experience. And I think once, just like many assignments and projects that I work on, once you start to form a connection with someone, and that's as simple usually as an introduction and a conversation, it's amazing how willing people are to share their stories and to be photographed and to share their knowledge. I mean, I didn't know about the resources that were available in this community, where to meet people, what that looked like. So I feel like between your knowledge of those resources in our community, but also largely because of the people we talked to, we ended up at day centers. We ended up at church services. We ended up at community centers that provided meals and showers. And then we even ended up in a homeless encampment where people were staying. So they really shared a lot of their life with us.
I think one of the things that was key for us to be able to do that is those relationships. I have good relationships with a lot of the providers, and that's the only reason a lot of these folks were willing to trust us, was having Pastor Jamie say, "These are our friends, and they're trying to do an important project. If you're happy or willing to share your story with them, it would be really helpful, and I trust them." And getting that implicit, or explicit, actually, "They're cool, you can trust them," I don't think that they would have talked to us otherwise. Because we went to Anchor Church, that's where we're kind of talking about, twice. And the first time, there was a pastor who's not the usual pastor. And then the second time, it was Pastor Jamie, who's been at the church for several years. And she said explicitly, "Oh, yes, these people, you can trust them, this photographer, this reporter." And then immediately we had like several people willing to talk to us. So that was key. And it's clear to me that these folks who work in the community day to day have built so much of that trust.
I was blown away time and time again meeting the wonderful people that work in this space and have committed large parts of their lives to working with people who are homeless. Pastor Jamie is absolutely no exception. She was wonderful, and that makes all the difference in the world. You want to be able to go into an event or a location, and for the first time, no one knows you. It's understandable that they might be hesitant. And so to have the endorsement of someone who has spent so much time there is absolutely invaluable.
So your photos are beautiful that you've taken of these folks. I just kind of want to ask for your process, what you thought about as you were taking these photos and what you were trying to get out of your subjects as you took these portraits.
Yeah, I think as with any project that I'm working on, my goal is always to collaborate with the people that I'm photographing. So what I care most about is that they feel comfortable and that they feel like they're in control. I think especially in this story, having your photo taken, you can feel like you're losing some of that sense of control. And this is already a community of people that maybe feel like they don't have control over their lives or some of the decision-making process that affects them. So it's really important to me that in the photographing, they feel like they're equal part collaborator and subject. And then I try to think about everything I do when I'm photographing, composition, light, emotion, to take the viewer beyond just a singular moment in to really feel a connection. And I think that's the best we can possibly hope for as photographers, is that someone will see themselves in the person that they're looking at. And without that, I think it's very hard to grow empathy or to connect with someone. So I realize that's probably somewhat idealistic, but I say, why not strive for that? I think it's really important.
Absolutely. I feel the same way about audio. I think that photos and audio kind of share that mirror kind of experience, where when you're listening to audio, it's like you have that person literally whispering in your ear, telling you the most sincere, heartbreaking story. And it's hard not to feel that empathy. So for that reason, it's my favorite medium. I'm not a visual thinker, so that's why I stuck to audio.
Yes, I learned a lot watching you too, because I agree that those two mediums work really well together. And I've always thought that. But yes, it's a totally different way of thinking, a different way of gathering material. But I was really grateful to work side by side on this project. And I think it just makes the project that much stronger.
Absolutely. Thank you for putting your brain together with mine to put this together. And thank you so much for everything you've done.
Thanks so much, Kelly. It was absolutely wonderful to work with you on this project.
Stay tuned in the next segment when we'll be going to Anchor Church. You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Newsroom from WHQR Public Media. I'm Kelly Knoyer. Thank you for staying with us. I want you to close your eyes and see yourself on the Riverwalk in Wilmington, down by Dock Street. The tourists and townies mosey on by on the Riverwalk, enjoying the peace and serenity of the Cape Fear River. As you walk by the pirate-themed barge restaurant, Anne Bonny's, you might hear a peculiar sound. Hymnal tunes and peaceful guitar drifting across the water as dolphins swim up the river. Some of the tourists might rubberneck, wondering who's there to hear the music. They'll glance over and walk on. Meanwhile, the homeless congregants pause on the Riverwalk for a cigarette, watching the sermon from there to keep an eye on their shopping carts. Sometimes even tourists are enticed onto the barge by the gentle guitar they hear. Soon, the ad hoc church's congregants will head down the little ramp onto the barge, gathering together in a patch of peace on a Sunday morning. The housed and the homeless both come together these mornings, clutching cups of hot coffee and enjoying a hot meal. This happens most Sundays. It's the Anchor Church, a United Methodist congregation for the homeless. Pastor Jamie Thompson has volunteers bring coffee and breakfast, and the congregants serve it. Everyone is invited onto the barge, the unwashed and the poor, the wealthy and the privileged. The aim, she says, is to build community together and build peace together. Sometimes finding that bit of peace is hard, really hard. People with so little can fight over it, and those conflicts can make it onto the barge.
You put assault charges on somebody and never did anything. It's because you're fat, doesn't mean I can't pick you up.
On this particular Sunday, two of the congregants had had some kind of altercation overnight, and that anger came up again when they both showed up in the same place. The pastor kept the women on opposite ends of the barge and told one of them to focus on looking out over the water.
Melanie, you're good. You know you're good. You're good. You just sit right there, focus on calming down.
Those challenges, whatever they are each Sunday, tend to drive whatever Pastor Jamie Thompson says in the sermon. She lets the conflict wash off her like water off a pelican's back.
Take no credit, take no blame.
And and she asks her congregants to find a new path, one where they love each other and rely on each other.
This is like practice. Being here together, it's like practice. We're practicing being together differently because we know that that's possible. And is gonna happen before and after, and it's gonna go down before and after, and somebody might get their ass whooped and their stuff stolen and all kinds of other stuff. But for just a few minutes right here, we're gonna breathe together. And we're gonna pay attention to the presence of God, to the presence of something sacred. For just a few minutes, we're gonna practice what it could be. We're gonna practice believing that we really do need each other to survive. That nobody's okay until everybody's okay.
Photographer Maddie Gray and I attended Anchor a few Sundays while working on our series of homeless profiles, set to come out next week. And I think the service is surprising in a number of ways. So I asked Pastor Jamie Thompson to come into the studio to talk about her congregation, serving the homeless, and what the housed can learn from their less fortunate neighbors. I started by asking her to describe the Anchor.
We really exist now in this season to build community with people experiencing homelessness. I don't really see the Anchor Church as a service provider necessarily, because I'm not a service provider. I'm a preacher. So I'm here to kind of build community with folks, especially across lines that divide us. So yeah, that's what we do. And we gather and share meals together and get to know each other and try to connect on a deeper level, and so we can see each other's humanity. And yeah, that's kind of what we're about, honestly, mainly.
How did it get started and where is it located?
Well, it got started on the streets of downtown. Anchor's been around for a little over 10 years now. It's gone through some different iterations, but at this point in time, the Anchor doesn't have any property. So we meet thanks to the goodness and hospitality of Ann Bonnie's Bar and Grill. Go eat at Ann Bonnie's. And they let us gather there on Sunday mornings before they open for business. So that's where we do our Sunday morning gathering. But yeah, I think it was really, truly just sincerely born on the streets of downtown, just wanting to sort of connect more with folks.
So I've gone to Anchor a couple of times now, and there's a couple of things I've noticed. It's not a huge congregation, and it's very different. There's a mix of a few people who are clearly housed. You know, you can tell because of the clothing, the jewelry, the hair. Like, they don't look like they just slept outside, and they look like they're very comfortable. And they often are the ones bringing breakfast and coffee. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then there's a pretty wide swath of people who are unhoused, some of them in mental health crisis, some of them, doing drugs there, but, you know, they've recently have or whatever. There's a lot of different folks who kind of end up in this place together on this barge. Mm. And I just kind of want to know what it feels like to you to try and lead such a diverse group of people, often who are really at the end of their rope because of the experiences they're going through.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good summary there, Kelly. Yeah. Oh, no, that's great. That's great. I like the observations. I didn't quite get a class like this in seminary, I'll say that. And, you know, for me, one of my favorite sort of organizers and writers, Adrienne Mary Brown, she has this thing of less prep, more presence. That is very much my approach for Sunday mornings. Now, when I'm preaching at the big church, right, at Grace, it's like all about prep, you know, like let me have this, you know, sort of manuscript and all these things. But, you know, on the barge on Sunday mornings, you're right. Like, you never know what you're going to get. People, if their stuff just got stolen, they're going to be mad. If it rained the night before and everybody's like wet, people are going to be irritated. And so, yeah, it's this gathering. I mean, it's just people in all of their sweaty, frayed humanity. And my approach to leading on Sunday mornings is to is to just be very, very present to whatever the energy is in the moment and to meet that. And to me, I think that is the essence of what Jesus was about, for one thing. But Christianity at its best, that's what we're doing, is to just, yeah, read the room in the moment and meet the energy where it is. And I'll say this, too, about those Sunday gatherings of just, like, this wide swath of people, like you said. What makes Sunday morning special? There's this concept in the Hebrew Scriptures called shalom. And my favorite definition of that is, individually and collectively, shalom is when nothing is broken and nothing is missing. And it's when everybody has what they need to flourish. And my best hope for Sunday mornings, when all these different people who really shouldn't be together in such a way on one level, is that we rehearse shalom. Like, we have this little dress rehearsal of, there's a different way we can be together, you know, and we can practice what it's like to be together differently. When, yes, people have come from, they're in dire straits. They are literally at the end of their rope. They have tied a knot and they're hanging on. But they also bring something. They have something to offer in that moment, you know, and they might get on the microphone and they might share a story. They might. And then also those people who have brought the breakfast, who have come from a house that was, you know, heated and cooled appropriately, like, they can come into that space and recognize, oh, God, like, I'm getting something that I didn't even know I needed today. So I like to think of Sunday mornings as like a little dress rehearsal for shalom. And it is short, but hopefully it gives us just enough a taste, you know?
I do feel like that setting is so peaceful. Mm. So, you know, it's right on the waterfront. You're overlooking the river. There's pelicans diving into the water. You're just watching, like, this majesty. Mm. And I think that, you know, you're playing the guitar. There's sort of this peaceful vibe. So I think that that rehearsal makes a lot of sense. And I definitely see the need for that peace in a lot of the unhoused folks who are coming to the barge. And obviously they also appreciate getting the breakfast and the coffee. They don't always get meals on weekends, especially. Mm. But I'm curious what you think the folks who are housed are getting out of that experience.
Hmm. Yeah. So there's this preacher and scholar named Sam Wells, and he preached this sermon years, years ago. But he said this: poverty is a mask that hides people's wealth, and wealth is a mask that hides people's poverty. And for the people who are showing up, who sort of have what they need materially, you know, who have money in the bank, maybe who have multiple houses, right? There's something in that connection to humanity. There's something in that connection to creation itself. It definitely stirs. It definitely stirs. And I like to think it's that. They're getting that what they need. I mean, we're masters at, like, these silos in our society, you know? And we're masters at deluding ourselves into thinking that we are unaffected by this thing over here. And we're not, you know? Even if we've numbed ourselves to that, we're not. Whatever is affected over here affects all of us. And I don't know if it's that. I don't know if it stirs compassion. If it stirs even just the fact that, how can people who are living in such conditions continue to have joy and humor, faith in some instances, and not always, but how can they continue to just have what they have, even in that? And I think that a lot of times folks who have what they need materially even see that and think, oh, my gosh, like, and notice their own lack.
One of the folks who's at the center of the stories that I'm working on is Leroy, and he is so helpful. Like, he goes out of his way to help everybody. He serves the meals. He's just sort of there for everyone. Like, he's been through so much in his life, and his story is shocking to people like me who haven't been through what he's been through, but he still manages to just sort of keep himself, like, contained and help others, yeah, you know, despite being in such dire straits. He still manages to, you know, if there's something bad happening, I'm going to make sure that I'm not a part of it, and I'm going to do what I can to help other people. And when you have nothing and you still manage to have that generosity,
yeah, Absolutely.
I don't know. That is something special.
Gosh, yeah. Yeah. It truly is. Absolutely. Yeah. To see people come through and put money in the jar, you know? I mean, just something simple as that. But, like, just speaking to that generosity that you named, I mean, people who have so few things, their radical generosity, I see it all the time. You know, I mean, it's staggering, really. And I have absolutely had conversations with people who have plenty of money, see that. To be in all of that, it does something.
Yeah. I was shocked to see people put money in that jar, too. But it happens.
It does.
When you're preaching a sermon, somebody will come onto the barge and they'll put all of the money from their pockets into that jar.
They will. Yeah.
Is that because they feel such ownership of the barge or because they value it? What do you think that is?
Gosh, giving back is just really important to people. You know, I just see that so frequently. And I love it because there's one fella in particular, and he'll come to me and he'll say, I had a pretty good night last night. And he just hands me this little wad of like $1 bills. And it's like there's just this deep commitment to take care of each other. Gosh, I just feel like it's driven by this need to want to care for the work we're doing, the ministry we're doing, too. I don't know.
Does the anchor need those donations to continue?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's absolutely. I mean, you know, we get a lot of things donated. I mean, people donate breakfast, people donate things. But, oh, gosh, yeah. I mean, the money is always a thing, right? I mean, on a good day, what do we have, like $20 in the jar? That's a real good day. You know, I'm the highest giver at the anchor. So, yeah, we're always playing those games of how are we going to keep going.
You're listening to The Newsroom on WHQR Public Media. I'm Kelly Kenoyer, and what you're listening to now is an interview with Pastor Jamie Thompson, who's the pastor at the Anchor Church, a congregation of the homeless that meets on Sunday mornings at Anne Bonnie's restaurant. I guess I want to know, like, what you think people should know about homelessness and about the people who you serve.
You know, like, they are us. We are them. I mean, I don't want to be cliche about that, right? But the root of so much of what we have going against us right now is that we don't identify with each other. On any level. And we don't see people's humanity. We don't know people's names. You know, it changes an awful lot when you learn somebody's name, when you hear the tiniest little details about their life, you know. It doesn't even have to be monumental, you know. When you just learn that, oh, like somebody doesn't like eggs. It's something as basic as that, like, can be the opener to more conversations, you know, like, where did you grow up? What has your life been like? And it's just that. I mean, everybody is a person of infinite sacred worth. I mean, just period. And I've honestly given up on trying to convince people of that. Like, it is so useless. I'm far more inclined to say, come and see. Like, just come hang out. I'm far more inclined to say that now. I feel like if the last 12 years have taught me anything in ministry, it's that, Jesus, like, God, people cannot be convinced of things, you know? But when they experience something, I do know that changes things.
The thing we were talking about before we came into the building together is that I recognize people's faces downtown and know them by name and say hello and talk about the weather with them. And I think that folks who are listening to this would be surprised to hear that they never ask anything of me.
Yeah.
They're not asking me for money. They're not asking me for anything. They're glad to be treated like a person because that happens really rarely.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so good, Kelly. Yeah. I'm glad you said that, actually. People rarely do that to me, too. It is so rare that people will ask me for money or even, I mean, they might on a desperate day say, like, have you got a pair of extra shoes or something? But it is so rare that anyone ever asks me for money. It is just the simple, basic act of just treating somebody like a person. Yeah.
A lot of them deal with all this undirected violence, people throwing rocks at the unhoused or trying to beat them up late at night, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And often the victims of it, from what I've heard, are the most mentally ill among us. You know, people who really should not be in the streets at all and should be, I mean, nobody should be in the streets.
Sure.
But folks who ended up in the streets because we got rid of all of our mental health facilities in the 70s, you know, those are the folks who are most likely to be the victims of this violence. And I think a lot of the folks who I've talked to in the streets, like, they just have such a clear-eyed view of humanity because they see the best and the worst of it.
Oh, gosh, you're so right. You're so right about that. And, you know, my experience with this community, like my experience with folks who are out there surviving on the streets, is they know people hate them. Like, they know people hate them. They know people don't want them around, don't want them at their business. They don't want them at their churches a lot of times. I mean, like, they know how despised they are. It is one of the most heartbreaking aspects of it. So yeah, the most basic acts of just human kindness, are like, you know, ripples on a pond. I mean, it goes so far. But yeah, I think I would also want people to know that, because I think I've said that a couple of times in individual conversations, and people are actually really surprised to hear that, but it's true.
That brings me to that question of, you know, a lot of folks think, well, they did something to end up here, so they deserve it, you know, or why don't they just get themselves out of it? And do you think they deserve it? I mean, does anybody deserve that level of indignity as a human being?
No. And we could sit here and name names until the cows come home of people, who were doing everything in their power, right, to try and get to a different place, to literally pull themselves up by their bootstraps. People are working hard. They hustle. They try. I mean, I say this often because I got this from the scriptures too. Poverty is a sin. Like, poverty is a sin. Being poor is not. Even when it comes to like the crimes and stuff, the crime is that we even have this rampant death-dealing situation of widespread homelessness in a nation that has so much. That's the crime, not being homeless. And it helps me even think about, even when I'm dealing with individuals who have done, who have stolen, right? People steal things sometimes. Like, when you're in that desperate of a situation, you just really can't say what you would or would not do.
I mean, we live in a country that is increasingly saying, yes, we can criminalize the homelessness. Yeah. At the highest echelons of government, the Supreme Court recently ruled in this Grants Pass case that it is totally okay for cities to outlaw homelessness and to say, you don't have anywhere to sleep, and that's a crime.
Right.
You are committing a crime by sleeping on public property. When you see the government taking that turn, what turn do you wish they were taking instead?
Man, I wish we would be taking the turn of, we can't have this. We can't have people living like this. People deserve a place to stay. People deserve care. People deserve medical treatment. People deserve to live and be and breathe. People deserve that. And if we believed that every person is a person of worth and value, then that's what we would be doing, right? We would be working to find a different way to be together. It's pretty demoralizing to linger in what's happening up there. And I mean, I know it's unavoidable. I'm not saying I stick my head in the sand, not by any means, but it's pretty discouraging.
What I often hear in my stories in the comments sections, what I hear from city council members is these folks are choosing this lifestyle. They'll say they chose to be on drugs. They deserve this. They could stop doing drugs and then they could become housed. And I guess I'm curious about your reaction to that. Like, should it be the responsibility of the rest of the community to help people who are making bad life choices like this?
Well, first I want to say I think it's a very self-serving thing to believe, right? It's very convenient to hold that and stand by that. That serves you very well, you know, because if it is all their fault, then I don't have any responsibility. So that makes perfect sense to me. My question to that is, like, what if it's more than that? What if it's more complex than that? Now, I know that's not what we're getting at here, but that's just a very, very convenient and useful belief to hold. So I get it. And it also keeps you from ever having to be in proximity, right? From ever having to get close, listen, be humble and curious. So that serves you well. I don't have all the big answers, but I think one simple answer, and I get this from my faith, I get this from my understanding of the scriptures, I get this my understanding from the life of Jesus and the ministry of Jesus, that we do belong to each other, and that when one part suffers, like every part suffers with it. And again, we can numb ourselves to that, but if we break our foot, our hand isn't going to say, ah, I got another one. We're going to limp. But if we were to heal that foot, right, we may be able to skip and run and dance again. So I do think we have a commitment to take care of each other. And I think that does and should translate into policy. Justice is what love looks like in public. You know, Cornel West said that. And so I think that we should be organizing for that. I think we should be fighting for that. But I'm just a lowly preacher.
I mean, I do wonder what it would look like if we organized our society around some of those ideas more. One of the things that stood out to me doing this story, of the five people who I interviewed, I think four of them had domestic violence or some kind of abuse in their background, either domestic violence in a partnership or sexual abuse or physical abuse when they were children. These adverse experiences are often what cause people to fall down and end up in such a desperate situation. Adverse childhood experiences, the more of them you have, the more likely you are to become addicted to a substance.
Right.
Because you're trying to escape the pain in your soul, you know?
Yep.
And they have to face that while also facing the daily experience of trying to survive in the streets.
Exactly.
Like, the strength of character to do that is insane.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder what it would look like if we organized our society to say, okay, so you've fallen through the cracks. You clearly don't value yourself because you've hurt yourself this much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how can we help you see in yourself what you see in everybody?
Yeah, that's it, Kelly. And when we do that, like in our best moments, when we do that and we surround people with the support and the care that they need to get them to that healthier place, like the other thing that happens in that is we unlock all this potential that's there, right? I mean, there are poets and chefs and construction workers and painters and mechanics. I mean, there are like people who have all these gifts and skills and passions. I mean, there are people who are great with kids. There are people who can write and teach people things. And that's the other piece that we don't fully grasp, right? Like when people are trapped in the trauma and the violence and all the things that like keep them in this place, like it's also robbing the rest of us of all of these other pieces of them and all that they have to contribute and offer. And if they could be freed up to offer those gifts to the world, like that's when we all get better, you know? And maybe that's the other piece that I wish people could kind of think about and see. You know, we would all benefit if people who are always having to focus on survival and just staying alive, if they had the bandwidth and the freedom and the space to offer more of what they have, if we were more committed to helping people get to a better place.
So if I'm an average person listening to this conversation and I'm inspired by everything you've said, what should I do to help make this kind of change in my community?
The first thing is show up. Maybe show up not even to serve or work or help. Just show up to listen. Show up to learn. Yeah, that could be on a Sunday morning at the Anchor or somewhere else, you know? It doesn't... Just be curious. Get curious. I feel like Anne Lamott has this great quote. She says, one of my favorite prayers is, Lord, help me not to spew my do-goodery all over everyone. Folks who have stuff and money and houses often think, And a lot of times it's guilt-driven. It's like, oh my God, I'm so guilty because I have all this. Let me go do something for someone. I get the good heart of that, but maybe even the very first step is just showing up to listen and learn. Meet someone, introduce yourself just as a fellow human, and just start from there. Like, that's one tiny small step. I swear, I feel like some of the best things that happen on Sunday mornings are when people just come to be in the same space together and let it go from there. Like, the next step will show itself.
Well, Jamie, thank you so much for coming into the studio. I really appreciate your expertise and your thoughts on this.
Thank you so much for having me, Kelly.
That was Pastor Jamie Thompson from the United Methodist Church, who preaches at Grace Street United Methodist and at The Anchor early on Sunday mornings. Tune in to WHQR all throughout next week to hear profiles on some of the congregants and other unhoused people in the Cape Fear region. Up next, we'll hear about a group of unhoused people you'd rarely notice, homeless students and families in New Hanover County schools. I'm Kelly Kenoyer. Stay with us. You're listening to The Newsroom on WHQR Public Media. I'm Kelly Kenoyer. We've heard all this hour about an upcoming series profiling homeless folks in the Cape Fear region. But there's a group who I simply couldn't report on publicly, homeless students in New Hanover County schools. There was a federal act passed in the 1980s intended to protect homeless students. It's called McKinney-Vento, and it ensures the educational rights and protections of children and youth experiencing homelessness. I brought in the district's McKinney-Vento liaison, Lisa Brenner, to explain how it works and talk about this vulnerable population in New Hanover County.
So the McKinney-Vento law actually is a little more expansive than what someone's traditional idea of what homelessness may look like. So under McKinney-Vento, students would qualify if they do not have adequate, regular, or fixed housing. So it may look like someone that is staying in a hotel temporarily due to loss of housing, someone that may be doubled up with another family that may not be a permanent situation, but they're just staying either with a relative or a friend temporarily, typically due to a loss of housing or economic hardship. It can also, inadequate is if they're in a housing without running water, electricity, things like that. They would qualify under McKinney-Vento.
I know that a lot of family members in these situations, you know, the parents, they don't want to be caught being homeless because mm-hmm. they're afraid that it'll lead to DSS or CPS coming and taking their kids from them sure. if they don't have adequate shelter. So do you run into that problem a lot? And do you think that might lead to an undercount even with the school system?
I think that's always a concern. One of the things that I think that we've done extremely well over the past few years is really educating our staff in recognizing during enrollment signs that, hey, this family may not have adequate housing or permanent housing. And then really making sure that they understand we do not report to DSS when we enroll a student in that's doubled up or in homeless situation, but we want to make sure that we can get them enrolled. So the law actually states that we not only will enroll them immediately, but we'll enroll them immediately if they don't have all the proper paperwork. So we have to remove that barrier. The law, you know, really is written to ensure that every child experiencing homelessness accesses their free and appropriate education. And so whether it's transportation or enrollment paperwork, anything that may serve as a barrier, our goal is to remove that so that the students can be successful in school.
Why is it so important that there's a specific carve-out for homeless students or students who have insufficient housing? Why is there a federal law for this?
So many reasons, really, but we want to make sure that a lot of the things that families that are experiencing housing difficulties become barriers to them being able to access school. So, for example, if I'm moving from one house to another, staying with friends or staying with relatives, that can actually shift school districts. So a student that's identified as McKinney-Vento has the right to stay in their school of origin, and then our district provides transportation to them. So it's one more stability that we can offer them is that you may be sleeping somewhere different each night, but you go to the same school every single day where we can provide those services for you.
What is the impact of homelessness on a student's ability to show up meaningfully in school? Mm-hmm. Homelessness is such a unique and challenging issue. So mm-hmm. what does that lead to in terms of the student experience?
Well, I think it's as diverse as the student population, to be honest. Every child, either the impact or the experience is very different, which is why it's important that we look at every single student individually. In many cases, experiencing homelessness can lead to attendance issues, which there is a direct correlation between attendance and student success. When you're worried about whether or not you're going to be able to eat, and there's tons of research that says that impacts your ability to learn. And I have a lot of experience working with high school students who often feel that they are somehow responsible or want to be helpful to their parent in addressing the challenges that the family is experiencing as a whole. So in some cases, it can be taking on a more adult role. It's just a wide range of experiences that they go through.
So I know that you help students get transportation to school, but what are some of the other resources or ways that you can assist them in coming to school ready to learn?
Yeah, so in New Hanover County, we have incredible community partners that really step in and help us meet the needs of our students in a variety of ways. We are able to offer them counseling. One great benefit is that we have mental health therapists in all of our schools that can meet the needs if necessary. We offer assistance with food through programs such as NC Nourish. We offer tutoring, assistance with uniforms. Also, if they're applying to college, we can provide a letter to the college, a FAFSA letter verifying their experience, which also will help them gain access to the funding to be able to afford college.
So I want to ask about the numbers on the ground right now. How many homeless students are there this year?
So we just finished up our count for the school year, and there were 910 identified students. And that's the students that are currently enrolled and their siblings, young siblings.
How does that number compare to previous years?
So it's down some from last year. Last year, we were at 1,264. So that is a slight decrease, but if I look over trend data in New Hanover County, it just kind of teeters somewhere between 900 and 1,200 and some back and forth. It's fluctuated.
That is so many students.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just sort of overwhelming to imagine, and especially with such a small team that's working on this. I know mm-hmm. that you have less than half of a position whose job is to do the McKinney-Vento assistance. But it sounds like the social workers are also helping with this.
Yes. Our school social workers are absolutely amazing. They are the ones that are really working face-to-face with our families. We have a social worker currently in all of our schools. And so they know our families. They identify our families. They make sure that the students have what they need. They advocate for the families. And they go above and beyond to make sure that they're connected with community resources when they're needed.
I know that the social workers are a huge part of taking care of these students. And we're losing a lot of social workers with this upcoming budget. So how do you think that's going to impact the programming for these students?
So we will still have social workers that serve in the majority of our schools. One of the things that I can say about them is that they are extremely dedicated group, and that even though there may be some shifts, I know that they'll have to prioritize the work that they're able to currently provide. McKinney-Vento will rise to the top of that priority.
That was Lisa Brenner, New Hanover County School's McKinney-Vento liaison. That's about all the time we have left for the newsroom. Thank you for listening. Thanks also to my editor, Ben Schockman, and programming manager, Ken Gamble. And thank you to the Fourth Estate Fund, which provided a grant to help make this reporting possible. If you have questions about today's programming or ideas for a future show, you can email us at newsroom@whqr.org. If you missed any part of this show, you can find it at whqr.org or get the show as a podcast pretty much anywhere you get podcasts. And just a note, our Google Podcasts have migrated over to YouTube Music. And don't forget to tune in next week as we publish profiles on homeless residents of Wilmington. I'm Kelly Kenoyer. Thanks again for listening to The Newsroom from WHQR Public Media.